we took our resources and focused them, as we were requested to do, on helping Shell move forward for this drilling season.
Interior Secretary Sally Jewell defends the administration's approach to Shell's Arctic drilling proposal. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a researcher moves to Dillingham to try to understand the region's high rate of sexual assault.
I thought to myself, why not go up there and start peeling back a few layers of the onion to really understand why this is happening a little bit more.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University offers working professionals courses designed to fit their busy lifestyles. With hybrid online and in-person classes, the MBA at APU is an accelerated, affordable, and high-quality pathway to career advancement. Learn more by calling 800-252-7528 or visiting alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
With the state facing a deficit of more than $4 billion, the budget is arguably the most important issue facing the Alaska legislature this session. The House Finance Committee is now hearing from the public on its cuts in preparation for any changes it might make to the spending proposal. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez has been following the hearings and joins us. Hi, Alexandra.
Hello, Lori.
Alexandra, what's been the public response so far?
Public testimony started yesterday, with people physically present in Juneau first invited to speak before the committee took to the phones. The scene was kind of a zoo. The committee room was standing room only, and people lined the halls to get in and say their piece. As soon as their 2 minutes was up, people were shuttled outside the door to make more space for others. On top of the 15 hours of testimony the committee has scheduled, they're also taking written statements, too. So far, the committee has received about 500 pages worth of letters, and plenty more are still rolling in.
What issues have gotten the most response from the public?
You know, it's often said in the Capitol that every state dollar has its own constituency, and we're seeing that maxim play out with these hearings. You have parents and teachers opposing cuts to early education programs like Best Beginnings and the state pre-kindergarten program. There were deaf men and women who spoke through interpreters about interpreter services being cut, which was pretty striking. Listeners of public radio asked for station funding to be restored. Attorneys and people who have received pro bono representation from Alaska Legal Services spoke against cuts there. The removal of Medicaid expansion from the operating budget was also a touchy issue. People also testified on cuts to the ferry system and to the state's timber program, along with plenty of other issues. One thing that has been interesting is that you really don't have people calling in to say we need further reductions. Some have acknowledged that the state is in a difficult position given the multi-billion dollar deficit, but the testifiers are mainly people who want to protect programs that matter to them.
Well, Alexandra, how much have legislators cut from the operating budget so far?
Nearly $250 million over last year, which is simultaneously a lot of money and almost nothing at all when you look at it in the context of a deficit that's more than 10 times that amount. Because more than half of state operating spending comes from formula programs like school funding and Medicaid, there's only a little over $2 billion in agency operations where the legislature can make direct cuts that don't require extra legislation. Really, you could wipe out all of those agency operations and still not cover the deficit. Some agencies are feeling the cuts more than others. Three departments, Labor, Military and Veterans Affairs, and Commerce, are all seeing their budgets reduced by more than 30% over last year. Meanwhile, the Judiciary and the Department of Public Safety are looking at cuts of 1 to 3%, respectively. One interesting fight that's been playing out right now is between the governor and the legislature in terms of who is making more meaningful cuts. Depending on how you look at it, the governor is reducing his budget by 30%, and the legislature is only cutting its budget by 3% over last year. However, lawmakers and their staff have been quick to note that part of the reason it looks like the governor is cutting so much is that the executive branch doesn't need to spend money on one-time things like election staffing and the redistricting board anymore. Also, some of the spending on domestic violence programs that used to be in the governor's budget has been shifted to agencies.
All right, so what's the plan with the budget moving forward?
After public testimony is done, the House Finance Committee will start taking amendments. They're hoping to move the bill out of committee by the end of next week. And after that, it'll go to the floor for a vote and then get sent over to the Senate, where that body will have the chance to make its own cuts or restore funding in some places if they so choose.
Okay, thanks so much, Alexander, for that update on the ongoing budget process.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
That was APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reporting from Juneau. Last summer, Shell asked the government to extend its offshore drilling leases in the Arctic. Today, U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski pressed Shell's case to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell in a Senate hearing. Murkowski says Shell needs certainty to continue to invest billions of dollars in its Arctic operations.
And because of this very short window, a 75-day Arctic drilling season and the difficulties and the delays and the legal challenges that are all out there that Shell has endured for the past decade, there really are not enough drilling seasons remaining for Shell to complete more than a handful of exploration wells before the Chukchi lease portfolio expires.
Jewell says the clock on Shell's 10-year leases in the Chukchi Sea was stopped for a period when a court ruled the government had to redo its environmental impact statement. Jewell says her department is still considering Shell's request for a 5-year suspension of the lease clock.
We took our resources and focused them, as we were requested to do, on helping Shell move forward for this drilling season. I also know that we are actively working with them on suspensions, and I think they can expect an answer in the relatively near future.
Oceana and other environmental groups oppose giving Shell more time on their leases. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan today engaged the head of the EPA, Gina McCarthy, in a testy exchange. Sullivan's focus was the EPA's proposed rule for the Clean Water Act. But first, the senator extracted some crow from McCarthy for dissing gifts given to her when she visited Alaska last year. Sullivan says her reference to moose meat that could, quote, gag a maggot was disrespectful to Alaskans.
It doesn't show that you are focused on serving the people that you're required to do. Have you had the opportunity to make a comment on that, apologize? If you'd like to apologize here publicly, that would be fine.
I'm happy to apologize for those remarks. I will tell you they were taken out of context, but it doesn't matter because they hurt individuals
and tribes
that I care about.
They sure did.
McCarthy has repeatedly apologized for the GIF gaffes, beginning days after the remarks were published in a Wall Street Journal profile of her. Sullivan moved on to the Clean Water Act rule. Sullivan says a lot of Americans think the rule is an unconstitutional expansion of the Clean Water Act beyond what Congress has approved.
I asked for the legal analysis that you said your agency undertook that says that the waters of the U.S., the regulation you have is a legitimate agency function because it's based in statute.
You said
you were going to provide that. We have not seen that.
McCarthy pledged to give Sullivan a copy of the rule, which includes the legal analysis. The rule is highly controversial, with some opponents saying it will regulate ditches and puddles. More than 1 million people have submitted comments on it. McCarthy says the rule is a clarification to comply with Supreme Court rulings and, compared with to current regulation, shrinks the acreage covered by the Clean Water Act. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book looks at the history of the Iditarod.
Rick Swenson plunged into the storm, and he's the one who came out with his fifth title. And here we are 24 years later, and that is still the record.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Legislators, aides, and others heard an alternate alternate viewpoint on Medicaid expansion from a senior fellow with an organization that has referred to the dangers expansion poses in states that opt for it. Christy Herrera with the Foundation for Government Accountability spoke to problems that she said some states have experienced. Herrera spoke during an informal lunch and learn sponsored by Senator Mike Dunleavy. State Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson, who also attended, questioned Herrera's use of data in Arizona and Maine, which expanded Medicaid on their own and not under the federal health care law. Herrera said those states billed as cautionary tales provide a longer-term view of data. Governor Bill Walker is planning town hall meetings to tout the benefits of expansion and rally support as lawmakers consider it. The Alaska Healthcare Commission would be eliminated in proposed funding cuts from the House Finance Committee. The commission makes policy recommendations to the legislature and the governor to improve the health of Alaskans and control healthcare costs. Representative Dan Sadler, a Republican from Eagle River, chairs the subcommittee that is recommending the cut. He says the commission has done good work, but health department staff can provide the same expertise.
I think every department would love to have its own policy think tank, but in our fiscal challenge these days, we simply can't afford it for this department and probably couldn't afford it in other departments either.
The Healthcare Commission costs the state $350,000 per year. The committee decided to keep funding for the Commission on Aging, which is also under the Health Department and costs $400,000 per year. The legislature established the Healthcare Commission in 2010 and voted unanimously to fund it for another 3 years during the last legislative session. Representative Les Guerra, an Anchorage Democrat, thinks cutting the Healthcare Commission is short-sighted.
We have the highest medical costs in the country and the state. We have the highest annual increase in medical costs in the country and the state. Their job is to help us come up with policies to stem that increase. That'll save money for the budget. It'll save insurance costs for individuals and their insurance premiums. Cutting them is just not a smart thing to do.
The state is responsible for more than $2.5 billion in healthcare spending each year. That includes employee and retiree health plans, healthcare for prisoners, Medicaid, and workers' comp. Overall, healthcare spending in Alaska amounts to an estimated $10 billion annually. The state is once again looking to move the wildlife trooper patrol vessel Stimson from Unalaska to Kodiak. And this year, the change seems poised to go through. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more on what it would mean for the vessel's crew and the region it covers.
Officials in Unalaska fought hard to hang on to the trooper's biggest patrol vessel when the move was on the table a year ago. But this time around, city manager Chris Laddick says they've had to reconsider their priorities.
I just don't see us, with this budget climate, being able to save everything.
Moving the 156-foot Stimson to Kodiak would save the state almost $500,000, says Wildlife Trooper Colonel Steve Baer. It's either that or cut three jobs, meaning he says the transfer is all but a done deal.
I think everybody realizes that during these tough economic times, that some of the politics that may have saved projects like this in the past just aren't going to happen.
The savings with moving the Stimson come primarily with salary and housing costs. Baer says their employees in Unalaska make 60% more than those in Anchorage because of the high cost of living. They also live in state-leased housing at around Anchorage rates. If the Stimson's five-person crew, their families, and one of Unalaska's two troopers moved to Kodiak, they would take a pay cut and would have to find their own housing. It would also mean a loss of several students from Unalaska's schools, which are already running a deficit due in part to declining enrollment. But Baer says the Stimson's mission wouldn't really suffer. In fact, he says they've already planned around added fuel and travel costs.
We could move the boat, sail an additional 27 days, and we'd still save about $480,000 a year by doing that.
The Stimson spent 116 days on the water last year, patrolling fisheries in the Aleutians and western Alaska. It's a bigger area than they used to cover. The vessel was brought to Dutch Harbor in 1998 to police the Derby-style crab fisheries. Back then, boats were racing to fish, even in dangerous conditions. Now, with quota doled out among the fleet, Baer says the Stimson can focus on species besides just crab.
The fishery is a lot cleaner and a lot safer than it used to be, and I don't think people feel the need or urge to make the risk that they used to in the past. And I think that frees the Stimson up to do other patrols. They do spend at least 30 days a year patrolling the salmon fisheries in Bristol Bay.
They also cover cod and even the caribou season in Adak. So for Unalaska-based Trooper Sergeant Robin Morissette, a move could just mean more sea time in more places.
If they see where, you know, it's a couple more days of the boat driving from Kodiak out here, well, that's a couple more days of going through the south part of the Alaska Peninsula to get out here to where we work, and then two more days going back, that's four more days in that area that we see that area.
Chris Laddick, the city manager, wondered if the Stimson might be busier in the Aleutians as companies like Shell Oil establish a regional presence. But Colonel Baer says, except in special cases, the wildlife troopers focus on what's in their name.
Wild resources, you know, the fish and the game of the state, not oil resources.
The troopers do have another vessel on similar patrols, the 121-foot Woldstad, already based in Kodiak. But Baer says it's long past due for an engine overhaul that would take it out of service for several months.
It can be used. It's still operational, but we're trying to be very cautious how much we use it because the engines are so far past the rebuild date.
The Stimson got that kind of rebuild a little over a year ago, so Baer says it can help cover the Woldstad's patrols well into the future. The plan to move the Stimson is part of the state's proposed public safety budget. It's currently making its way through legislative approvals in Juneau. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
A researcher from the University of California, Irvine, is in Dillingham to hear from sexual assault victims about their experiences. KDLG's Matt Martin reports the idea is to figure out the cause of the disproportionately high number of sexual crimes in rural Alaska.
There have already been a few studies that looked at the quantity of sexual assaults in rural Alaska. According to an FBI report, there were 80 reported rapes per 100,000 Alaskan residents in 2012. That was the highest in the country. Jeremy Braithwaite is a PhD candidate in criminal justice at UC Irvine. Reading the reports on the high incidence of sexual assaults in Alaska, he noticed none of them offered conclusions as to why that is. The Californian packed up his bags and moved to Alaska to see if he could help figure that out.
So I thought to myself, why not go up there and start peeling back a few layers of the onion to really understand why this is happening a little bit more?
Braithwaite's research is unique because it goes beyond documenting the magnitude of the problem, as other studies have done before, but trying to explain why the problem exists in the first place. He started interviewing women in Dillingham about 2 months ago. So far, 9 women have participated in his study.
And when you look at a very small community like Dillingham, Alaska, to talk to 9 women that have been affected by sexual violence, that's a very, very high number.
Victims tell Braithwaite that they have typically been discouraged from sharing their stories of abuse and assault.
Everybody has said when they came forward and talked to somebody at that about the abuse, they were told, don't talk about it. That's ugly talk. We don't talk about that. So not being able to communicate that violence just pretty much allows it to continue. You know, if you don't talk about it, it doesn't go away.
He is still in the early phases of his research, but already one theme has emerged in his interviews that he has conducted.
Obviously, the alcohol problem and the heroin problem in Dillingham have been unanimously named by everyone.
Braithwaite says that collecting these stories should help better identify some of the root causes of sexual violence here. He hopes that that may lead to more effective ways to address the problem. When he finishes his work here, Braithwaite says he wants to repeat the study in other rural parts of the state. In Dillingham, I'm Matt Martin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The city of Fairbanks is rolling out a new approach to law enforcement. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the mayor and police chief introduced the community policing program at a public meeting in the Fairbanks crime-plagued South Side on Tuesday night.
Mayor John Eberhardt told about 100 people who packed the meeting room at the J.P. Jones Community Center that the new policing policy represents a departure from the way law enforcement officers have traditionally operated.
It's a different philosophy. It's a different way of forming closer relationships with your community.
Chief Randall Aragon says that old approach involves a routine response after a crime has been committed.
Call the police, send a car, make an arrest.
Aragon says the old approach is reactive and largely ineffective because police get reports of crime after the fact. The suspect is long gone in about 75% of the cases. And he says there's typically only about a 5% chance that police will be able to arrest a suspect. The chief says a different approach is needed, especially for troubled areas like Fairbanks' South Side.
We're writing an excellent police report, but that bicycle from that neighborhood, they continuously get stolen. No one's working on how to solve the problem. Community policing is trying to prevent it from happening in the first place.
Aragon says community policing is intended to help residents both protect themselves from becoming crime victims and help police prevent crimes in their neighborhoods. He says that requires police to get out into the community and build trust with its residents. To get the dialogue going, Aragon polled residents on their major crime and law enforcement issues. They came up with a list of 17. The top three were drug activity, speeding, and a lack of respect shown by police. A couple of residents raised concerns over what they thought might become an overly intrusive police policy, but most of those in attendance, like the Reverend Joe Blackburn, seemed comfortable with it.
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea. I think it's headed in the right direction. It shows concern.
Blackburn, the pastor at Mount Pleasant Baptist Church, says he's hopeful that community policing will build the trust needed to encourage residents to interact with police and overcome concerns that some have about law enforcement.
Just feeling comfortable and not feeling that every time, you know, you see a policeman that he's there, you know, for a, you know, to arrest you or serve your warrant or something.
Officer Richard Sweet has been heading up the community policing program on much of the South Side for about a month now. He says he hopes it'll help residents understand that fighting crime is something most everyone can agree on.
The hope is that it's not an us-them proposition between the police and the community. Everybody's together.
Aragon says he'll convene another meeting on April 30th at the J.P. Jones Center to check back on how community policing is working. He says the program will be phased in citywide in the coming months. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A new book out just in time for this year's race documents stories of the Iditarod. Lou Friedman, a former Anchorage Daily News reporter and author of numerous other books on Iditarod legends, gets people who race or love and support the race to tell their own stories. The book is called Iditarod Adventures, Tales from Mushers Along the Trail. Friedman starts with Martin Boozer. He says he's had a question he's wanted to ask Boozer since 1991.
That was the year everybody was convinced Susan Butcher was going to win her fifth title. The weather changed at the very end. A famous incident on the trail. She and Joe Runyon and Tim Osmar turned back to White Mountain, said it was impossible to go on, and yet Rick Swenson plunged into the storm, and he's the one who came out with his fifth title. And here we are 24 years later, and that is still the record. And the only person who chased him was Martin Boozer. And up until then, Martin had been, you know, a guy in the mix, third place, fifth place. But and in the next year, Martin won for the first time. And I always wanted to know if his dogged pursuit, so to speak, of Rick Swenson and dealing with the harsh conditions that everybody's these other people said were impossible had set him up to win. And he indeed agreed.
You have obviously been around the race and around a lot of the people that have been involved in it for many years, both from your reporting and just because you have interest in it. Were there things that, such as this story that you just relayed about Martin, that really surprised you as you were doing some of the interviews with some of these mushers, things you didn't know or wouldn't have thought?
I don't know if the surprise is the right word, but there were always things I learned
I didn't know about Hobo Jim's background in Alaska. And it was funny to hear the origin of how he wrote the song that everybody identifies with the race. And he was struggling with what was he going to sing, and when, and it had to be ready under a deadline. And he was scrawling out these things and running them by his wife, and she would say, no, that's not it. And then finally he did wake up in the middle of the night with the words, and woke up his wife and started singing the song again, which became I Did, I Did, I Did, or I Trail. And she actually said, go back to sleep. It's not the one. But he got up the next morning, was out having breakfast, and then the whole rest of it came to him in his head, and he wrote it out on a placemat at a restaurant. I always remember the Libby Riddles, you know, telling the story in when she won the race in 85, how when she realized she had it won, and she was picking up KNLM radio out of Nome on her last 22 miles in from safety, and they were playing I Did, I Did, or I Trail, and Libby had the wonderful comment to say, and it was like they were playing it just for me.
What's the effort with this book for the public? What do you want them to come away with? What are you hoping they learn by reading this?
I hope they learn who the people are behind the numbers. I mean, an awful lot of people, more than ever, follow the IDURA through different kinds of social media and online, who've never met the people, who've either and never seen them. Even. And this way, I hope they can learn a little bit about the people behind the big fur hoods that are obscuring their face in the cold, assuming there will be cold this year along the trail, the shortage so far of snow and cold, and just, you know, and how they bond with their dogs and some of the stories of, you know, what they think their special teams have been and their special dogs and their relationships, and just what they... in some cases, go through on the trail when it's hard. I mean, Martin was pretty darn vivid about making it sound like it was a war zone sometimes, you know, that a soldier was sleep deprived and struggling to survive against the elements.
Lou Friedman's new book, Iditarod Adventures, Tales from Mushers Along the Trail, is in stores now. He'll be signing copies Friday evening at the Anchorage Museum and on Saturday at Barnes & Noble. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Matt Martin in Dillingham, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Doyon Limited, announcing the 2015 Board of Directors election, encouraging e-proxy or paper proxy submission no later than Tuesday, March 10th before 5 p.m. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.